Welcome to Anxious Like You, a podcast hosted by Micheline Maloof and Nadia Adesi, two therapists who are anxious like you. In each episode, Micheline and Nadia dive into their guests' experience with anxiety and give you the tools you need to face your anxiety head on. This podcast is made in collaboration with Dive Thru, a mental wellness company.
Welcome back to Anxious Like You. Today, we're talking to Svetlana Chernyenko. She's a Canadian mental health advocate, activist, mother, model, writer, and businesswoman. She is also an advocate for mental health, anti-bullying and domestic violence, and of the Me Too movement, a supporter of the LGBTQ Plus Foundation and Women's Equal Rights Foundation, as well as a supporter of the Diversity and Inclusion Foundation and the Black Lives Matter movement. We are so excited to have her on, and this will be a somewhat triggering episode as we will be talking about suicide, depression, and many things that could potentially be a little bit troubling for some. So this is your trigger warning. So today we have Svetlana Chernyenko on our show. We're going to talk about her journey through mental health. And you guys sent in some questions on our social media platform, so we will definitely be sure to get to those as well. So let's just dive right in. You've struggled with mental health your whole life. Can you talk to us a little bit about that journey and what that was like for you?
Well, the journey really started when I was about 19 years old. I was going through a domestic abusive relationship. I never really realized that anything, well, we called it something being wrong with you at that time. And I didn't really realize what was going on with me. I was in a domestic abusive relationship since I was 16 years old. I got pregnant at 19 and 20 years old, you know, the relationship really got me rock bottom because the person that I was with abducted me. And he abducted me with my child, with our child, essentially, when our child was almost a year old. And it was 3 weeks of hell for me because I just wanted out of the relationship. I couldn't believe that I had allowed this to happen because I knew I had a choice not to allow that to happen. From that point on, it was like, okay, I got home, police brought me back home, everything was good, quote unquote. But I wasn't good. You know, I was having a lot of dark thoughts. I didn't realize that the thoughts and the dreams that I were having, that it was PTSD. I had no idea. So it was consuming me. I felt like I was a bad mother. I wasn't, you know, able to take care of my child. I felt like that I had failed him. Being such a young mother and having my first child, I could barely even look at my son knowing that I put him in a position that almost took his life and mine. And as ironic as it is, I tried to commit suicide. And that was the turning point for me, was when I woke up in the mental health hospital here in Canada. And that's when I knew, okay, this is that bad. And I was lucky enough to survive. And when I woke up and I had the psychiatrist and the doctors around me, they're like, we need to hold you. We need to have a talk with you. We need to see what's going on in order to be able to help you. And I think that was the most pivotal moment of my life, was like, wow, something is wrong. Something was wrong with me and it wasn't all in my head. And I'm so grateful to be alive. Ooh, gets me emotional. I'm so grateful to be alive, to be able to get the help, because many people don't survive to be able to get the help. And I went through years of therapy. I saw my psychiatrist. I moved from therapist to psychologist to psychiatrist. I didn't know what kind of help I really needed, but my psychiatrist got me through it with medication. And I had guidance for years. And for years, it was my silent thing. Like, people in my family knew, my best friends knew, but people that saw me in my modeling career and outside, nobody knew what I was dealing with internally.
So you were suffering on your own for a really long time. And that's such a journey, you know, to be in a relationship for 17 years. I heard you say, I put myself in that position. But I'm wondering what makes you say I could have gotten out when you stayed for so long. What makes you think that you could have gotten out and didn't make the right choice? Is that what you're saying?
Well, my first relationship is when I was younger. I was with him for 6 years. My next relationship after that was for 17, but that relationship was, it was mentally abusive, which caused a lot of aches and pains. It was when I was younger. This was my first son's father, my first love, you know, that put me through all of that. It was when I got there, and I knew when I was being held by him. I hate using the word hostage, but that's what it was when I was being held by him. I was like, I couldn't believe that I allowed this to happen. And I because I had all the red flags. He was not mentally stable. He was extremely abusive, very manipulative, very narcissistic. Everything was there. But I mean, when you're young, you don't know. We don't have these types of conversations, especially back then. I'm 43 now. You know, this was over 20 years ago. We didn't have those type of conversations. You know, I have a background where I'm half Black and half Russian. You couldn't have a conversation with the Russian side of my family and be like, guess what? I have something wrong with me mentally, or even on the Black side of my family, because it was a taboo. So I was dumbfounded that I put myself, because I did. I had so many opportunities to leave. He had been arrested multiple times when I called police. Unfortunately, back then, they just let him go on $30, $40 bail. You know, in those times, it was hard going through domestic abuse, but I could have at that time. And it was after everything, when I tried to take my own life, is when I realized that, wow, this man could have taken everything from me, and it could have been worse. I was really one of the lucky ones.
You mentioned that it's taboo to talk about mental health with both sides of your family. So what pushed you to the point of, okay, now it's time to open up to them? Was it a lot of fear in you before you did it, or was it just that you couldn't hold it in anymore?
Well, with my mother, she was there, because my mother and I are extremely close. So she was there throughout everything that I had gone through. But in order for me to open up, it took so long. I was going through 17, which was the 17-year relationship after that, which was up and down, tumultuous, which was, he did not believe in mental illness. Very old school African man, older than me. He was like, no, it's all in your head. So I felt very insecure about having a mental illness. I felt ashamed. And it was only when my father in 2011, September 11, 2014, when he passed away. My son was born October the 24th, 2014. And it was after that moment that I ended that tumultuous relationship of 17 years. And I decided to make a complete drastic change. And I decided to raise money for a woman's shelter. And I went on national television with a friend of mine who's a broadcaster. And I shared my That's how I outed myself, essentially, to say, is I did it on national television.
My God.
Because I was so involved in raising money for this domestic abuse shelter for women. And there was a woman that I met that suffered with mental illness. And it was just like I was caught in this moment that I was so excited. I had raised so much money in a short period of time. I was in it. We're talking. And then it just came out like verbal diarrhea. And I saw everybody at the news station like, what is she talking about? Because nobody saw it, because I was always that, you know, fun person going out, dancing, making jokes, being silly. So everybody was confused. But yeah, that's how I outed myself.
So from 0 to 100.
Yeah, which that was in end of 2015, beginning of 2016. That's when I outed myself. Yeah.
I find your story so relatable because I think a lot of people don't recognize what they're struggling with. And a lot of people who are in abusive relationships don't know that that's what's happening. And they go their whole lives kind of wondering, well, why am I feeling this way? What is, wrong with me? Maybe they start to think that, well, my problems aren't that bad because I have a home and I have a family that loves me and I have a job, or, things are okay on different levels, but there's just something off, right? It could be a bad relationship that you can't even put your finger on, like what's going on. So when I hear people say, yeah, I was in a 17-year relationship that was mentally abusive, that's one of the hardest things to identify for people in it, right? Because you have that cycle that continues to happen. You have the honeymoon phase, and then you have the tension building, and then you have the events, and then it circles right back around. So it's almost like that intermittent reinforcement that keeps us there. So I think a lot of people can find themselves in those types of situations, not knowing, what's happening to them. when you were having that realization, did that happen after the fact yourself that, hey, this is what's going on with me? Or did you start figuring that out in it? Like, hey, I feel like I have some, you know, mental challenges that I'm dealing with in terms of like my emotions and mental health issues.
Well, I already knew I was dealing with mental health issues because to my previous relationship, I was diagnosed with PTSD, generalized anxiety and depression at 20 years old. I was already diagnosed. When I met my partner that I was with for 17 years, I met him when I was 24 years old. And, you know, him being older, I was like, oh, he's not the type of guy I would have dated, you know, and I figured in between there, I had, you know, one or two relationships that didn't work out. And I said, you know what, maybe this is it. And when I started dating him, I was I let him know. I said, you know, I didn't tell him everything, but I'm like, you know, I'm a little bit anxious. Sometimes I get depressed. That's how I kind of try to pacify it, you know, because I was a little bit embarrassed. I'm like, you know, a little anxious. Like, oh, and he was just like, oh, like most women. And I'm like, wow, okay, dude, that's kind of rude, you know? But, you know, I was going through the relationship and girl, red flag. Like if I had a banner going like this, red, run. There was so many in the relationship from the first 5 years. It was, yes, he always said that I was beautiful and complimented me. But then there was always this back-ended thing, you know, where he would pick at little things, like little imperfections and put me down. And I was like, you know, thrown aback because I looked at him like, well, he's not hitting me. That was my excuse. My excuse was, well, I thought about before, I was in such an abusive relationship. It was super violent. I was kidnapped. And this guy, well, at least he's there for me. He shows up and he doesn't hit me. So I went through this relationship of, oh, well, he doesn't do this to me. And girl, there were so many red flags that towards the end of the relationship, I was like, wow, as women and as people, we really want to fool ourselves into being in a situation where we're not happy just because we're comfortable. It was so sad that I watched my life flash before my eyes. I wound up having one child with him and then a few years later, another child with him. And it was only when, you know, there were tensions with his life, which then got exposed after I had my second child with him, I found out he was married to another woman. There were other children that I didn't know about. I knew about some children, but not girl, my life. I need to write a book.
Yes, you do. Yes. Oh my gosh. So he had a secret marriage this whole time.
When we met, he was getting divorced. So I knew he was getting divorced. I knew about the children that were there. I had met other children. I'll be straight with you. We were together. He was battling with his immigration. He was having a lot of issues. And I knew that about his relationship. I even offered to marry him to help him. And he was like, no, don't worry about it. I got this, you know, but I have to divorce my wife. It's going to be very complicated. And the reason why I never thought anything of it, because at first I was like, well, you're getting divorced, but you're still living at home. He literally bought a house and moved out. So why would I ever think he was still married or he was still having any relationship with his wife? Nobody in their right mind would ever think that. So I was like, well, okay. It was literally just coasting through. There were red flags, business trips and everything until he was deported. That's when I was like, okay, I went to Africa, let me go visit. And then I started paying more attention and girl, that's when more flags started coming.
Oh my gosh. Girl. And that's the relationship that led to you wanting to take your own life.
No, that was the first relationship. Like
the first one. Okay. And can I go back to that for a minute? I mean, suicidality is, you know, something that impacts a lot of us. And what feelings, like what was going through your mind that led you to feel like I can't do this anymore?
It was the fact that I was abused for so many years physically. I felt super insecure about myself as a mother. I didn't understand how I would I made this decision to have a child with somebody who is such a monster to me. The fact that I allowed him to lure me, because essentially how everything happened is he was from New York. He used to come to Montreal to visit me. And my mother was always like, I don't like this guy. I have a bad feeling. When we had a child, he went back to New York and I decided to break up with him. Well, you know, in my mind, I was like, it's over. He drove with a friend to Montreal to come visit me. And, you know, I felt comfortable. He was like, listen, come with me. I want, you know, my mom to meet our child. You know, my friend is here. It's safe. So I got in the car with him thinking it was safe, but I didn't realize my mother was begging me not to leave. And I didn't realize I was leading myself into that destination of that dangerous situation. Mm-hmm. So just knowing that I flashed everything. Cause when I woke up in the hospital, I was like, it was the thought of how could I do this to this innocent child? If I'm putting myself through this, that's one thing. Then I was like, what kind of mother am I going to be if I can't even walk away from situations like this and protect my child from danger? For me, in my mind, I felt that my child would have been better off without a mother like me, as difficult as it is to say now.
Wow.
I felt like he would have been better with somebody who could make better decisions for herself and for himself. And that's where my mind was at when I made that decision. And I swallowed a whole bottle of penicillin, and because I'm allergic to penicillin, and it was in the house. I was like, okay, I'm going to take it. And even my mother to this day is like, the way you even chose to commit suicide, I took a bottle of water. I don't know what I was thinking, but I was looking for some kind of like toxic content. I put a little bit of bleach in it, took the pills. And luckily my best friend walked in. Maybe she said it was about, she doesn't know how long it was, but I remember still being lucid and seeing her. And then I passed out, and then I was in the hospital.
Oh my God. Wow. Oh my God.
So from a therapist perspective, I'm hearing a lot of self-blame and self-guilt, and that's kind of led you to where you ended up. But when you did get that diagnosis in the hospital and from your psychiatrist, did it shift the narrative at all?
I was so relieved. Like, I have goosebumps talking about it now. I felt like there was this weight lifted off my shoulders, and I knew, because I always knew something wasn't right after everything that had happened. I just pretended like everything was okay. My best friend was like, well, you were abducted. Like, how could you be okay? You went through so much. He almost killed you. And I'm like, oh, I'm fine. Everything's good. I'm back. I was literally like just not paying attention to the fact that I had just gone through such a traumatic experience. So going through all of this, and the psychiatrist sitting down and telling me, this is your diagnosis. At first, it was like a long laundry list. I was like, oh my God, I am literally, the first thing, I'll be honest, first thing that came to my mind, I'm like, wow, I'm crazy. I am crazy. I'm like these people I see in the movies. I'm going to have this, you know, scarlet letter on me that I'm nuts. I'm psychotic. I was at that moment, it was like, oh my God. But then it's like that moment flew by so quickly. And I was like, but no, Lana, you know what's wrong now. So now you can fix it.
Yep. Yeah. So it was a long laundry list of diagnosis, which I'm sure it was like overwhelming at first, like you mm-hmm. said, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to go crazy. But then it was almost, at what point did it become okay, this is a starting point.
Well, when I was rambling in my head, you know, when we go through that, oh my God, and you're thinking of all the worst things, all of a sudden I took a deep breath. And it was when the doctor actually put his hand on me, and I was like, it's like he grounded me without even saying anything. And he's like, it's going to be okay. And I was like, oh my God, it's true. You know what's wrong now, because you knew something was wrong and you didn't know what was wrong. And it led to so much after that, because it was like, okay, I have to be on medication. Cool. I went through medication, which wasn't an easy road for me, because I was one of those people that I had all the symptoms and side effects of this one, had to switch to this. And I would get frustrated, and because it's a challenge. It's such a challenge to find the right medication. And that's something that I want people to understand. Medication isn't a quick fix. You have to do the work. You have to go to therapy. You have to find the right medication with your doctor, and just be patient, because your body needs time to deal and cope with the imbalance, the trauma, the everything that you need to take that time. But, you know, I'm glad that I went through everything that I went through, and I wouldn't take it back for anything, because it's made me who I am today.
Wow. So powerful. Do you mind sharing what diagnosis, what were on that list?
Yeah. Well, it was, the first one was generalized anxiety. So I was like, I didn't know what it was at the time. So I was like, okay, great. PTSDC has stated that I had the same form of PTSD that veterans had in military. And he explained that it was a cluster, and I was just like, okay. And then he's like, well, and you also have manic depression. You go through huge manic states, because they watched me, and I was really going through these highs and lows. And he says, we need to watch you, because you have the precursors for being bipolar. So we need to watch that because of your manic state. So I was just like, PTSD, generalized anxiety. I was like counting, like, I just can't have one.
You have to have all of them.
Not just all. It made me more interesting.
yeah. So you got a list of diagnosis, you got medication, the psychiatrist calmed you down just by grounding. It's amazing how much someone just being there for us and just kind of like, finally someone understands what's going on. And I'm, that's the turning point. That's when you're like, okay, this is, I've got somewhere to start. And how was that being reunited with your son after, you know, leaving the hospital and having this list of diagnosis and medication and the support that you needed? What shifted, if anything?
Oh, a lot shifted. I still felt a lot of guilt when I looked at him. You know, he was still young. He was a little over a year at the time. And, you know, he was a mama's boy. So all he cared about was being home with me. And, you know, with my mother, she was there to support me. She then started opening up to me to let me know that my grandmother, her mother, had suffered with mental illness. And I had no idea. And she felt guilty. She felt like maybe this had something to do with it. So I came home to my mother feeling guilty, me still feeling guilty looking at my son. But I realized that I needed to make a change in my life and I needed to do better for my son. And I even needed to do better for my mother because I was the rock. In our family, I was always the rock. I'm my mother's only child. My father had other children. And I was always that rock for her and the rock for everybody in my family. So I was like, okay, I need to fix me in order to be able to help everybody else. Because I was always that, you know, that kid. If anybody came near my mom, any guy that was like flirting with my mom, I was like, no, you're not flirting with my mother. I was always her protector. And she realized that I needed that more TLC. Because my mother's extremely loving. I grew up with a mother who was extremely loving. She wasn't supposed to be able to have children, and then she fought to have me, so we had that closeness. So I came home to a lot of support from her. Friends, I lost a lot of friends. They were embarrassed, they were completely disgusted that they're like, oh well, you're crazy now. And you know, you're in your early 20s, you have a kid. It was already difficult, everything that I had gone through, but my best friend, she stuck by me. She was like, you know what, leave all these people alone, you need to focus on you, don't feel badly, feel better, because now you know what you have to do in your life.
And what did that look like for you going forward? Was it a lot of therapy? Like you said, a lot of trial and error, different medications.
It was it was a lot of, it was a lot of ups and downs. It wasn't an easy road. You know, where I've gotten to now, it's easier, but it's still challenging. I tell people it never goes away. It just gets a little easier as the years pass. But the first 5 years, it was just getting me stabilized on medication was very tricky, because I was having so many side effects and I was getting sick. And then between all of that, I was diagnosed with a heart condition called Wolff Parkinson-White with WPW. So some of the medication was affecting my heart. So I was like, you know what? So three issues with my mental health. I have Wolff Parkinson-White. What is happening now? So my 20s were extremely challenging for me. Then dating this man that, you know, I have my two last children with, I was just like, you know what? I don't know what plans God has for me, but I was just going through it. And it wasn't easy. My best friend said, she's like, you know what? You made things look easy. And that's why people never really wanted to believe you were going through what you were going through, because you were just, you know, I just didn't want that stigma on me. I was still embarrassed to have that, you know, scarlet letter. Oh, she has mental health issues. She has mental illness. I couldn't even say that I had a mental illness out until I was 37 years old, like actually physically say the word mental illness. I have a mental illness. I was like, oh, I have mental health issues. Mm-hmm. I was trying to find cuter words and terminologies for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Until national television, right?
Oh, girl. It was in November. I'll never forget it, because it was in November for Domestic Abuse Month, Survivor Month. And I was just like, and it just came out. It was just like, I didn't even expect it. I felt it. And I felt like spirit, universe, something was pulling me. And I said it and I felt so good. And since that day, that was the day that I decided to become a mental health advocate. That was the day that I stopped modeling. That was the day that I completely changed my life to serve my community, to use my platform and grow it, to be able to help people that live with mental illness, people that feel stigmatized, and also to educate families, people who have a loved one that's living with a mental illness and doesn't know how to communicate with them. I speak to them not as a therapist or psychiatrist. I speak to them as a person that lives with mental illness, that knows what it is to live with it, to be able to change the narrative, to have an open dialogue. I'm also here when psychiatrists write to me or therapists, you know, would you like to be a part of this study or would you like to help me write this piece? Because they know that I'm open. I'm here to help other people in any way that I can when it comes to the mental health community. I'm like, I'm there.
You're there. And you have been such a great advocate. Can you tell us a little bit about all the projects and advocacy things you're a part of?
Oh, well, I've done body positivity movements where I was in New York City in my underwear in really cold weather. I think it was at least minus 5 or 6, you know, in your underwear, it's kind of cold. So, but it was for body positivity. And for me, I was really focused about the mental health and the body positivity, because a lot of women, we tend to put ourselves down and we have a negative connotation about our bodies. Because at that time when I did it, I actually did a recent TikTok about it, where I was talking about that moment. I was extremely depressed when I did that body positive movement. Nobody knew, once again, because I was smiling and having fun, but I wanted to do that. And then from there, when I came back, I had to go through this new thing of flushing out why I wasn't happy and what was going on. And then from there, it just kept going. So I did body positive movements. I volunteered at shelters for women, at mental health shelters, for the homeless shelter, we raised coats for winter. Like, it's just, it hasn't stopped. I became a contributor for mental health for my local news station for Global News Montreal. Then I worked with CBC. I worked with so many news stations started approaching me because they saw my want and my need to help the community, to be a voice for them, to be able to answer questions that some people don't know how to answer because they feel embarrassed or ashamed. And it's taken me on this journey to be on your podcast and other amazing podcasts to be able to change the narrative and have this open conversation. So I'm super grateful that I took this leap of faith in a very quote unquote taboo subject.
Yeah, you're incredible. And we were talking about this before, just everything you do, your social media, we were listening to different podcasts and just in awe of everything.
Thank you.
What changed within you once you said, okay, I'm going to go on national television. This just came out, dropped the stigma that even I was holding myself about mental illness, and now just be as open as I possibly can. Has that helped your mental health?
Yeah, it really did, because I don't feel enclosed in this box anymore. I just went with that feeling. You know, sometimes we go certain feelings we shouldn't just jump and go for every time. You know, we have to like scale it in a little. But that moment, I was just, it felt right. It felt like I'm here to create change, because I know a lot of women that suffer with domestic abuse do suffer with mental illness, because I learned that along the way with therapy. And a lot of women don't feel comfortable to talk about it. So I wanted to show so many people, even men that were dealing with domestic abuse, that I suffered with mental illness. I try to take my life. I'm still here. I'm still standing. I'm thriving. I've done the work. I'm a mother. I'm raising 4 children. I'm doing things for my community. I wanted them to see that you can still live, that your mental illness doesn't have to dictate who you are. You can dictate who you are. You don't let it control you. I don't allow my mental illness to control me anymore. I have my bad days. Like, I know that I've been smiling and laughing a lot on this podcast because I want to be able to make talking about mental illness comfortable. I don't want to, you know, there are serious topics, but I also want to be able to laugh and smile, because mental illness sometimes, for me in my life anyways, it's been a little silly because it's made me do some silly things like being open on national television and outing myself.
Yeah.
I love that. So owning it is also taking control of it.
Yes, not letting it define you. But, you know, for me, it's like my mental illness has made me who I am. I'm resilient. I'm strong. I'm bold. I'm charismatic. And yes, sometimes I'm sad and I'm upset and I'm depressed. And it's okay. I tell people it's okay not to be okay. But don't pay rent there. Don't live in that feeling. Own that feeling and get the help. Ask for help. I even tell people, contact me if you don't know where resources are, and I'll give you websites of local resources in Canada and the US where you can go, who you can call. I mean, I can't help the whole world, but I figure that if I start the narrative on my platform and other people come and join me, you know, it takes a village. We can all come together and change the narrative and help a community and help the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've also been an advocate for the LGBTQ plus community. You're also part of the Black Lives Matter movement. You're also part of the Me Too movement. How do you move from, okay, because you're doing a lot, you know, there's so much advocacy work and so much help that you're doing. How did you get into all of that?
Well, I have a sister who's trans. She's actually a very good friend of mine who, you know, in the community, we're sisters. I've also been a guidance and like a mother figure to a lot of people in the transgender community. I do have a queer son who opened up to me a few years ago. So for me, being in the community of the LGBTQ plus since I was very young, raised by a gay uncle, I just felt the need to, you know, speak up for the community because there's a lot of mental illness in the LGBTQ plus community. There's a lot of attempted suicides. There's a lot of issues that need to be addressed. So I figured I'm already doing this. Why don't I just pull, you know, this part of this advocacy in? Because it just makes sense for me. As long as it's something that I'm already doing, why not just, you know, I'm adding to my plate, yes. But I'm also using my voice to help other people who maybe need a little bit of a bigger platform or a push. And then for Black Lives Matter, when everything happened with George Floyd, people were reaching out to me because they know I'm half African and half Russian. I lived in Africa. So they were like, you know what? We want you to be a part of it. You're local here in Montreal. I was approached more in the mental health side of the Black community and what's happening. But then, you know, I was invited to this march and gave me a microphone and I spoke for my children because I'm raising, you know, sons that are visible minorities that I fear when they go out pre-COVID, when, you know, getting pulled over by police. One of my sons has cornrows in his hair. You know, none of my sons sag their pants, thank goodness, because I told them, don't be that stereotype. It's already hard enough out there. And I just spoke from my heart, my soul of being a mother, raising visible minorities and having that fear and what I have to go through every day, that it's not just me, there are other people. So my advocacy has just led me to have a voice for people that don't feel comfortable, to speak for people who feel voiceless, because I went from that shy girl to being this boisterous, outspoken woman. And I'm proud of who I've become and I'm happy of who I've become.
An amazing person and helping so many. I'm in awe. Yeah. I'm like, I want to be best friends with you. Yeah. Once this pandemic is over,
we're going to do a sister circle and I'm coming. We're going to go to Ontario from there, hop on a flight, come meet you in Florida.
Let's do it. Once this pandemic is over, we have to. Oh my gosh. Such great stuff that you're doing. Now, talking about George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement and all of that, obviously what's been going on, you know, I'm in the US, so you've heard all of the stuff that's going on here. It doesn't change in Canada. There's still, you know, a lot of racism, systemic racism, a lot of stuff happening. What do you think or say to people who say that mental health issues and justice, social justice issues and racism issues should not be mixed?
Should be mixed because of the fact of systemic racism. When a police officer decides to arrest somebody based on their color, think about the trauma it creates. We just had an issue here in Montreal a few days ago. On January the 28th, there was a young man who was arrested in Montreal, and he was wrongly accused of attempting to kill a police officer. It wasn't even him, mistaken identity. I wrote on the platform saying, we need to think about one thing, it's a systemic racism, but we need to think about this young man, the trauma, the mental health issues he's going to suffer, the PTSD. He had never been arrested in his life. Now he's being arrested. He was going to court to find out, you know, all along he knew he didn't do it. It wasn't him. We have to blend those. It all goes hand in hand. When you pull somebody off the street because of the color of their skin and they know they didn't do anything wrong but be that color, that creates a mental health issue. It creates a trauma. So unfortunately, we need to blend that together. We need to have these conversations of that narrative, because even myself, I shared it very openly. Up to this day, in my car, I still don't keep my license in my wallet. I keep it in my sun visor. I keep it where I can have access to it because of the time that I was pulled over, where I was going home to the suburbs. And it was in the summertime. I had my braids in my hair because my hair gets really crazy when I go swimming in chlorine. And I remember when the officer told me, looked at my ID, you don't look like a Svetlana Chernenko. I'm like, he said it in French. He's like, well, you're Black. I'm like, yeah. He's like, but you're Russian. I'm like, yeah. So myself being a light-skinned woman, I know that it's rougher for those who are darker than me. I know the challenges because I have children who are darker than me. I have family members who are darker than me. I hear the stories and I hear the trauma. I'm scared when I see police driving behind me because I don't know. So imagine every other young Black man or woman, especially young Black men in America and in Canada, they're constantly being targeted. Their mental state, for those who are innocent, because I believe at the end of the day, if you're guilty for something, you did the crime, you should do the time, but it shouldn't be based on the color of your skin. Well, you know what? He looks like the guy because he's Black. Yep. That's the only reason he looks like the guy. Yeah. That's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in the Black community, it still remains less common for someone to seek out therapy or treatment. Mm-hmm. Not many Black therapists out there. You know, now there's more awareness with, you know, cultural issues and everything like that. But, you know, what advice could you give to somebody who is Black and struggling with their mental health, but finds it really difficult to have access?
Well, unfortunately, there still is the taboo. And thank goodness for women like, and I just want to mention her because she's an amazing person doing a lot for the Black community and mental health, which is Taraji P. Henson. She has been doing so much. I've been following her and I'm like, yes, girl, this is what we need more of, is we need more conversations. We need to change the narrative in the Black community and stop stigmatizing, because there's still that culture. Like my grandmother, she still has that culture. She's, you know, old Black woman in her 90s. Oh, honey, it ain't mental health issues that you have. She lives in Philadelphia. She's like, it's not mental health issues that you have. It's all good. You just need to change your diet, or you need to change this, or you need, there's like this stigma. And then if I talk to my African family in Africa, they'll turn around. Oh, no, 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 honey, it's voodoo. You know, I'm like, what is witchcraft? I'm like, it's not. Nobody put anything on me, you know? But yeah, that's what it is. It turns into those narratives. Yeah. Trust me, my aunts will be like, my daughter, it is not that thing, eh? It is not mental health issues, oh. You know, I'm like, but auntie, it is. And it's understood by, it's so old school. And it's just the way that so many were raised. Because I have many friends in the Persian community that tell me the same things. And in my Russian community, my mom's Russian, she told me she couldn't have those conversations. But yeah, for the Black community, there are so many charities that are opening up. I even have mine, Welcome to My Everyday. It's a charity, whether you're Black, Latino, white, it's a place that has, it's a safe space. You can come, you can ask for help, you can look for therapy, indiscretion, but do not be ashamed. And if you, I tell people, regardless of the color of your skin, but it, unfortunately, if you are being stigmatized in your own community, being Black, by your family telling you it's not mental health issues and you feel ashamed, just seek out the help somewhere, write someone, reach out to your local hospital. A lot of hospitals have psychiatric wards where they can pair you with a doctor. There are so many apps now where you can get therapy. Just reach out to someone, anyone that you can, because it's so important to start somewhere and get the help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned on your Instagram that your son and daughter struggle with their anxiety as well, or with their mental health. How do you change the narrative based on what you were told as a kid? And now what are you telling your kids?
Well, it was challenging, let me tell you, with my son, because he was going through suicidal thoughts and emotions. And there was a night I was with, I had a bad feeling and I heard he was still up. I went to his room and he was crying and I didn't understand what was wrong with, like, what was going on with him. I thought maybe it was, you know, something with his, in this, with his partner in the relationship. And he was like, I'm so sorry, mom. I'm like, why are you sorry? And he's like, I wanted to go and kill myself. He wanted to leave the house and he wanted to take his own life. And I'm like, I was so devastated, but I was holding the tears just to support him. And I said, but why? What's wrong? What happened? And immediately I thought I did something. I was like, what did I do? Did I miss something? How did I miss this? He's like, Ma, it has nothing to do with you. It's the pandemic, being locked in, not seeing my friends, being feeling trapped, you know, going from being a good student to failing all my classes. He's like, I feel like I'm failing the family. So I realized that he thought he was failing me, you know, because he was always a good kid. He still is an amazing young man. And I had to sit with him and talk to him. And I let him know, I said, it's going to be okay. And we're going to get you help. And immediately called my psychologist to help him with any form of therapy that she could provide for him, because he felt more comfortable going to a psychologist. And ironically enough, he was a psychology major, which now he changed majors. He's in real estate, but it was challenging for him. And with my daughter, it was, she was being bullied at school. And we had dealt with bullying before, because she was going through, going to a predominantly white school when she was in elementary school. She had even been bullied by a teacher. Then in high school, it's like the bullying happened again, because she's like, she was 13, looked like she's 16, 17, you know, she's developed much earlier than most of her friends. So the girls started bullying her and making fun of her because she's curvier than them. And it turned into like this body dysmorphic issue. And it just kept going where I, every day that I brought her to school during this pandemic last year, I was dropping her off at school when they reopened. And she was being found in the restroom having panic attacks. She couldn't even get an hour through school. And this was happening for a month. So I was like, you know what, Anastasia, I need to pull you out of school. We need to do something. We need to figure something out. So I spoke to the principal. I pulled her out and she's been homeschooled since then and going to therapy.
Wow.
Yeah.
For any of our listeners listening to this story, this is exactly how you put an end to transgenerational trauma. You acknowledge it, have a conversation mm-hmm. with your kids, and then do anything possible to connect them with a therapist, connect them with a psychologist, to help them not go through similar experiences that you did, or to just seek out any support that they can possibly get. And that's huge. And that's a hard thing for many people to do after years and years of stigma and trauma passed down through generations. Mm-hmm. So just mm-hmm. acknowledging that, good for you.
I just wanted to be different for them. I wanted them not to have to suffer. And I saw them suffering and I just immediately reacted as a parent. I was like, okay, I protect my children. Whatever mistakes I made in my 20s, now I'm a mother of four. I'm 43. I need to change the narrative. I need to step up. And I just went into action mode. You know, yes, I did cry after that in the evening. I was crying in the bathroom and my husband was sleeping because he's an essential worker. I didn't want to wake him up. There was so much going on in my head when he woke up. I was like, how do I tell my husband what's going on, you know, with his stepson? Because they're so close. My husband now, none of these children are his children. I met him, he was a bachelor and hey, you got four children now, you know, mm-hmm. and he takes his role seriously and he's so hands-on. So I was like, how am I going to tell him? And I told him, this is what's going on and this is what we need to do. And this is, and I was just like, almost in point form, action mode. Like, this is what we're going to do. And I agree. You have to just take action. Don't let the stigma, the taboo, the feeling that you did something wrong, the guilt sway you into just act, just go get the help, do it now.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful because so many parents are afraid of what that might mean for them. And I think there's these like blinders that some people put on because they don't want to feel guilt for whatever, you know, their child is going through. And it's never, you know, intentional. Nobody gets a manual on how to raise a child or what to do when they're crying or what to do when, you know, they're being bullied at school. And so, you know, taking action and providing them with resources like you did is probably one of the most powerful things that any parent can do. You know, we're not expected to have all the answers. So it's really good. It's such a good message because so many people can relate. It's like, what do I do? My son is, you know, having suicidal thoughts. And you know, what I've heard as a therapist a lot of times is, you know, parents completely dismissing that or invalidating that or saying you have nothing to be sad about. You have nothing to cry about. You have nothing. What do you mean you're suicidal? You know, get out. You have a roof over your head. You have, and it's so probably the worst thing that you can do. The best thing we can do is exactly what you did, which is, okay, I don't understand this fully. Or maybe you do because you've been through it. So for you, it was probably like, okay, I know what this feels like. And I know what they might need. But for many parents out there that haven't struggled with suicidality or depression or trauma, they don't know what to do and they somehow blame themselves. So, you know, listening to that message and saying, you know what, no matter what your story is, if a child comes to you with these issues, get them the help that they need because you can stop that right there.
I agree with you 100% because the problem is the kids don't come with manuals. I didn't know how to do anything with these kids. I tell my friends are like, how do you juggle everything having four kids? I'm like, honey, I'm like, just like faking it till I make it. I don't know. You know, I'm just doing it because I don't have, I'm a mother. We don't have a manual. Like, you know, it just gets better with each kid. So I was like, four kids, I kind of learned something along the way. But I look at it as we have to acknowledge, you know, because the best way for me to put it, my mind has like so many thoughts. I'm like, this is what happens. And my mind goes, stop for a second, pause, Lana. But we don't know how something affects someone. Like, you could wear the same shoe that I wear. It may pain you in a different way that it pains me. So we can't pass judgment. I can't say, well, you know, I've been through this, and this. Oh, that's nothing that you're going through. For some people, that small little issue that we may see as small could be something huge that we've gone through. We don't know how that little thorn that gets us, we don't know how bad it, it afflicts the other person. So we have to take it seriously and take it at face value. I don't like when I hear, oh, you're so dramatic. You're, because I've heard that in my life. You're so dramatic. You're so this, or get over it. You'll be fine. Oh, you have a great life. Why do you feel this way? We don't know what the person is dealing with. We need to take it seriously. We need to not stigmatize them even more in a society that it's still a taboo. And look at this, in a pandemic, we have so many people suffering with mental health issues that have never gone through maybe depression or anxiety in their life that are now going through it. And it's still a taboo subject. Why? Mm-hmm. Why are we not normalizing this? Because we still have people telling us to get over it. It's going to be okay. You're dramatic. My children's friends, I've been the community mom. I always had the open door policy because I'll be cooking in the kitchen, listening to music. Kids will come in. I feed the whole neighborhood. That's just always been me. And when these kids come to me and they confide in me and they tell me how uncomfortable they are, I get to know their parents more so that I can figure out how could I bring this up to their parents so I can get this child help. And I've been able to do it successfully last year with at least 5 of my daughter's friends. Wow. So being able to change the narrative and speak to parents that were, well, you know, it's just dramatic, or she's just being, or he's being this way. If I can make that little change to make these parents see it differently, then they may affect another parent that can help another child. And that's the domino effect that I want to create. And that's why I put my hand in so many pots to say, and yeah. I advocate for so many things, because I believe if I sprinkle a little in this pot, and this pot, it's going to keep going and spreading. That domino effect, like the butterfly effect. It's going to keep going and spreading. I can't change the world alone, but if I give a little bit of myself to each person of who I am and I impact them in a positive way, they're going to take that and it's going to impact somebody else and it's going to keep going. So I know that I have the capability of changing the world by one person at a time, by affecting them positively when they come to me, or they have, or even when we have this discussion. Mm-hmm. For your listeners or for yourself, it's really getting in the mind of somebody who's lived through suicide, who's lived through PTSD, who lives through anxiety, depression. I am the proof. I am living proof. I am so imperfectly perfect, but I love myself so much. I've learned to accept who I am.
Yeah. Wow. You're planting seeds everywhere, and all of these seeds are going to grow into huge trees. Amazing. Amazing. I want to kind of go back a little bit, because I know you experienced bullying as a child growing up, right? I was listening to another podcast that you were on, and you mentioned that you kind of got it from both sides. You got it from the white girls and you got it from the dark skinned black girls. So you were kind of, how was that experience growing up for you being bullied?
Well, I was in an era at that time, was which a lot of your listeners are going to remember, whether you're in Canada or the US or in Europe, is the dark skin, light skin era, you know, so it was really hard. And, you know, it was always a touchy subject to talk about colorism, and it's still a touchy subject to talk about it. But I'm so open about it because every person deals with their own issues. I don't know what my dark skin cousin, you know, went through. I only saw what she went through and it affected me. But I know what my light-skinned cousin went through because I went through it, being bullied because, you know, my mother put me in a Jewish school, which was predominantly white. And I was like, but we're not even Jewish, Mom, we're Russian, unless we're like Russian Jewish. And I didn't know, like, can you let me know? Let us just know, you know? But she put me in a Jewish school. And I mean, then I started having, you know, Shabbat dinners and things like that. I'm like, hey, okay, more dinners. But the issues that I went through was, I wasn't white enough for the white girls. You know, I had curly, kinky hair. My skin was darker. And for the dark skinned girls, they felt that with me not even having to do anything, but just being me, oh, well, you think you're better than us because you're light skinned. Because a lot of the guys were creating the issues back then. Oh, we want an exotic girl. We want her to look like this and be like that. Meanwhile, I was the one, like, I didn't know where I fit in at the time. I saw my cousins and I was just like, how, I want dark skin like that. Like, they're gorgeous. They're beautiful. I didn't understand why they hated themselves. And then I internalized it and I didn't know where I fit. And I started hating myself. I was like, wow, why can't I just be black or white? I came home like, Ma, like, you couldn't pick like a white guy or you know, a black guy who looked white, you know, like I was going off. I was like, seriously, and then you put me in a predominantly white school that the percentage of black people were so low. That I was like, and I wasn't the only target in high school. The light skin, dark skin era, it got so bad at that time. And now, you know, evolving into the stages that we are now, there's still issues of colorism. Even after what happened with George Floyd, it was kind of like, and I'm going to be very open, and I know it's going to be very touchy, but it's just who I am. I like to speak the truth. Mm-hmm. Is in this era, after George Floyd, everybody was like, oh my God, okay, I need to get a Black person hired. You know, going through this era of, I need to find a visible minority, a real visible minority. And I had, after the George Floyd incident, I had a lot of people reach out saying, you know, I'm really happy that you used your light skin privilege to speak out for the Black community, because people will listen to you because of the color of your skin. And it made me sad. But I realized even when I was in Africa with my family that that did happen a lot. But the issue that we're having now is a lot of my light skin friends are like, I'm so happy for my dark skin sisters. I'm so happy that they're getting the notoriety, they're getting put in places, but we're still, some of the light skin women are still being pushed to the wayside. Well, you're not really Black, you're mixed. I have friends who are as light as me, if not lighter, who both parents are Black. So there's still colorism. Companies and brands need to realize that if you want to take a visible minority, it should be of all shades, from Latina to Black to mixed, every different Southeast Asian, take everybody, make us feel equal and whole so we don't compete against each other, because it's still an issue with colorism now.
Yeah. And how did you get through all of that growing up? How did it impact your mental health, and how did you get through it? Because that's not easy. I'm Middle Eastern, and I got bullied a lot growing up because of my background and because I was different, and the food that my mom would send to school. And that was a big challenge. It affected me in ways that I completely pretended I wasn't Arab growing up and didn't want anyone to know. I was Latina in Orlando, because they were just more accepted. So how did you handle that? How did you cope with that?
It was hard for me because I just wanted to fit in somewhere. So then I was like sourcing out other mixed kids, but I'm like, are you mixed or are both? It was really awkward because I was just like, hi, how are you? I'm Svetlana. Sorry, back then I didn't even want anybody calling me Svetlana. So hi, it's Lana. And you know, what's your origin? What's your background? And funny enough, majority of my friends were Middle Eastern. Growing up, it was just like, I was like, what? A lot of them, because we moved from where we lived in Montreal, which, you know, was very culturally open. I moved to a place called Nuns Island, which was still pretty culturally open, but there was a lot of Middle Eastern people that lived there. So it was perfect. Yeah. But it was just like, because I had this one friend, Sana, and she was Middle Eastern, but she looked mixed. She looked like she was me. I was like, hey, she had curly hair. I was like, girl, you're my girl. Go home and meet her parents. I'm like, where's your Black mama or daddy? Because somebody in here is Black. You know? But I think for me, trying to source out more men and women, like girls and boys, especially girls that looked like me, I felt more comfortable. And it was sad because my relationships with my darker skin friends started getting tarnished because they were getting pulled. They wanted to be friends with me, but then why are you being friends with a light skinned girl? And I had my friends telling me that all the time, even my cousins, like, why, you know, my friends are asking, why do you want to hang out with her? She's going to take all the boys from you because she got that good hair and she's light skinned and she's this, you know, she's going to be competition. But I didn't see it as that. I'm like, we're just different shades of beautiful. And that's how my mother raised me, because my family goes from the darkest dark to the lightest light, that there's so many shades of us that I'm like, why would we disregard any shade? It's color is beautiful. It brightens up. Imagine if the whole world was literally, because we look at the color black and white, it's really not a color, but look at the different shades of human beings that we are. Why do we disregard that? So that helped me get out of it. And then when, you know, the dark skin, light skin era started changing, I was Latina for a few years because I had long curly hair. I went through that. And then I just started meeting amazing young women. Like I was 17, 18 years old, dark skin, light skin, Middle Eastern, this, that, everything. And I just, this group of amazing women, and it didn't matter anymore what color we were. We were just badass women hanging out together that were gorgeous.
Yep. So amazing. So amazing. I want to go into some of the questions because I want to be mindful of time, but we have some questions from our followers that I think are important to ask. So let me just pull that up really quickly.
Yeah. I think they go right into what we're talking about.
Exactly.
Actually. So one of the first ones was, how can you be a better ally for marginalized groups? if you do not belong to that group. So yeah, an ally essentially.
Yeah. Well, being a good ally is getting, I tell people, I look at my mother. My mother's white, and I've seen her becoming an ally, and how she became such a great ally being a white woman raising a biracial child was that she stood up for the community. She educated herself. So, you know, I would say educate yourself with somebody of that nationality or that race. Ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask questions so you can educate yourself. But do find somebody who's open to receive the questions, because sometimes people don't want to be bombarded with questions like, well, it's not our issue to try and have you become an ally. Or do your own research if you feel uncomfortable to ask a question. But educate yourself about either Black history or history of that time, slave times, the times that we're in, racial profiling, systemic racism. Try and read up on books, look at documentaries of people talking about it. There's so much information of people sharing their stories of being Black, being Latina or Latino. There's so many documentaries on systemic racism. Just educate yourself. Being like, for me, I'm not a lesbian. I always see myself more of being pansexual. I'm somebody who loves people's energies, but my whole life I was somebody who was straight, would be seen as straight. And I became a good ally for the LGBTQ plus community by asking questions, surrounding myself with those who would be able to help me understand better of how I can be of service to them. Really, it's about education. Educate yourself, and that's the best way you can be an ally.
Yeah. And I think another point that you touched upon that we didn't pay too much attention to that's important is calling out these companies to stop them from pitting us against each other. So with the colorism that's happening, or even with the LGBTQ, you're getting your main person to represent your company to check off all your boxes, but you're not representing the whole community and you're pitting us against each other. So calling those out, emailing, contacting, social media, I think is huge. And I think that's important for our listeners as well, because it was one of the most common questions we were getting. And that's such a great point.
It's a collective, because they are still putting us against each other. Can we just stop? All shades of color are beautiful. And I'm honestly so happy that a lot of visible, like darker skinned women, are getting put in positions that before they wouldn't get those positions because of the color of their skin, which is absolutely asinine to me that they weren't getting these positions because of something so irrelevant. Instead of looking at the content of the character, like Martin Luther King said, they were getting judged by the color of their skin. And for me, it's just like, wow, this is amazing. But when companies are taking, hey, I'm going to take the darkest girl that I can to represent the whole Black community, it doesn't represent the whole Black community, because there are mixed girls. We need to have faces. So if you're putting that dark skinned woman that's there, that's a visible minority, to reach your quota, hire some other people of some different shades of Blackness that's beautiful too. We're like, the melanin is gorgeous. There's so many shades. Don't put us against each other. Bring us together so we don't have another light skin, dark skin era.
Yeah. And that goes with LGBTQ, and that goes with mental health. We don't want just that one. We appreciate it. I mean, it's come a long way. We get that representation, but it needs to be across the board. It can't just be that one token person, like you said.
No, there needs to be many. Like my sister, she's Latina, transgender woman. She's absolutely beautiful. I would want to see her more in the forefront and in the limelight. We need to take, instead of the real, like, okay, this is my quota, I'm going to take somebody that will not mistake this person as being a visible minority. Why not take, even if it's a little confusing, I wonder what nationality she is. It creates a conversation. It changes the narrative. And it's an interesting conversation. Well, what are you mixed with? Because I have friends that you would think are mixed like me, and both their parents are Black. And it will gobsmack some people. Then you have some people that I know that are Afro-Latinas that are super dark skin, and both their parents are light like me. And you're like, what in the... You know, but that's what I mean. It's changing that narrative and stop putting us against each other and stop taking the token person, but take all of us.
Absolutely.
What can people do? Because one of the questions we got is, what can I do as an ally if I don't have a social media following?
Oh, you know what? I've gotten that before too. They're like, well, I can't do anything. I don't have a social media following. Well, you know what? It takes a drop of water to build an ocean, to create an ocean. So it's that one message that you have. Find a way to get it across. Start somewhere. Speak, vocalize. I always tell people, don't be afraid and say, well, I'm not known, I have 10 followers. Well, why don't you look at the people that you follow? Write them a message, because I respond to a lot of my followers. And if they have a really strong and positive message, guess what? I'm sharing it. I'm talking about it. I'm tagging them on it. So if you feel that your platform isn't strong enough, take the time to write to people, because there are people that will share the story, that will help you. And they, it won't matter if you have 2 followers or 100 followers, they're going to look at the message and the change, the impact you're trying to create. And if that person is for the same change, they are going to help you.
What a great message. What is some, one last piece of advice you can give our listeners who are struggling with their mental health and possibly thinking about ending their own lives?
You know what? I know life is hard and it's challenging. And I, even sitting here today, I've had my challenges the past couple of weeks and months, and I'm able to smile and laugh only because of the fact that I'm able to acknowledge that, yes, I have a mental illness. I have a few mental illnesses and it's been hard. And with a pandemic, it makes it that much more challenging. Life can have obstacles, but life is so beautiful. It's so amazing. We're here on this earth to learn, to listen, to meet new people, to experience the human experience. And I know sometimes it gets so dark and you don't see the end. I used to say, well, yeah, I see the light at the end of the tunnel. It's the train coming to hit me, because I literally was in such a negative space in my life. It's taking a moment and taking a breath, because when we're in that negativity and that thought process of, oh my God, everything's going so bad. My life is this, my that, I'm fat, I'm this, I'm ugly. And you're just rambling in your own mind. It's your mind creating these narratives and this darkness, and to the point that you are talking yourself to the ledge. You need to start learning to reinforce the positivity. Stop comparing yourself to somebody on social media. This is why I push the narrative to do things differently. Just accept that I have a problem, something's wrong. Don't be afraid to reach out. Reach out to anyone. Life is so beautiful. You are worthy. You are worth it. Just get the help. This is something I beg people, just get the help. Ask. I know I was a very prideful person. Asking for help was one of the most difficult things, but it's been one of the most rewarding things in my life, is just reaching out. It could be a stranger. If you're afraid to get judged, just reach out to somebody and say, hey, I know you don't know me. I need help. Can you help me? Can you direct me somewhere? You'd be surprised. There's so many amazing human beings in this world that are willing to help if you're willing to ask for it. But if you're suffering in silence, nobody can help you, and it's just going to get worse. And for those people that go through those dark thoughts and those dark moments, trust me, I understand you. I feel you. I was there. I was there more than once, and only one time that I actually have, and I say, the guts to take my own life. And I'm still here for a reason. God has me here for a purpose. The universe has me here for a purpose. And I hope that my voice, my message reaches you, that you understand that you are never alone and it's never as bad as you think it is. When you do the work, and it's going to be hard and it's going to be challenging. And even for me, I tear up, I get emotional thinking about it, but these are tears of joy. I'm so grateful that I get to wake up every morning and I get to see my children. I get to see my mother. I get to breathe and I get to learn something new about myself and about life. And I get to get old, because that is a privilege of life. So just remember that and take my words with you and carry it in your heart that you're not alone. And I want you to one day feel this joy that I feel and have this overwhelming sense of tears of joy.
Just made me cry.
I'm like, first time I've cried on the podcast.
Goosebumps and tears. That was the most beautiful message. You are a powerhouse. You're amazing. You are here for a reason. And I'm sure so many people are going to be resonating. I mean, they've already resonated with your message, but will continue to resonate and possibly even choose to live because of that message. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that brings me so much joy. You know, it's these messages and being on podcasts like yours that help spread my message. That's where the tears come. It's a lot of joy. I'm so overwhelmed with gratitude and joy.
Amazing. Thank you so much again for being here and sharing that beautiful message. And this is not the end for us. We'll definitely have to party it up once this pandemic is over and spread some mental health awareness together on some sort of mental health awareness, I don't know, road trip or something.
Road trip campaign. We'll do it, man. Let's do it. We'll do it. You know, the world needs it. The world needs to understand that we need to have these conversations, and it's okay. So it's okay not to be okay. And I want people to understand that. Don't feel shame. Come out of the darkness, come into the light, do something silly. It's what I do. When I feel really depressed, I'm like, okay, today's the day it's about to go down because I need to cheer myself up.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, thank you again for being here. Thank you so much. And where can you tell our listeners where they can find you?
Well, it's very easy with me. It's The Real Svetlana everywhere, whether it's my .com is The Real Svetlana, my Instagram, my Twitter. And I'm still trying to get the hang of TikTok, so bear with me, but it's The Real Svetlana on TikTok as well. And I've been changing the narrative on my platform by sharing more messages of what I share on my Instagram of self-love, positivity, and mental health. And you get a little goofiness of me every once in a while. But yeah, The Real Svetlana everywhere, and that's how you can find me. Follow me, stalk me. No, don't stalk me. Follow me. Question. You know, I'm here. I'm here for that. I'm here to really live the human experience. So thank you both for having me on your amazing podcast. I'm so honored and touched to be here.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Absolutely. Let's keep in touch, thank ladies. You. I'm serious. Yes. I'm doing that trip. I'm like, ooh, y'all don't know what you
Let's
guys
do it.
Into.
We're ready.
This silly girl.
You don't know what you got yourself into. You don't know what you got.
I did.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, make sure to subscribe and leave a review. Join the Anxious Like You community by following @AnxiousLikeYou on Instagram. See you in the next episode.